Welcome to the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, a show dedicated to the artistry and science of sports field management and celebrating the groundskeepers who create those masterpieces. The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. On this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast, we'll finish our two-part interview looking into some family baseball groundskeeping history.
And we've got a new segment to introduce to you guys today. We're calling it the Diamond Da Vinci's Maintenance Calendar. Although, if you've got a better name, please email us.
And on today's Out of the Park segment, we'll continue our theme of family history and baseball groundskeeping by speaking with Roger Bossert, the head groundskeeper for the Chicago White Sox and the third generation of the Bossert family who has ruled in Major League Baseball for over 80 years.
After that, we're going to keep it in the family in our not-so-turf science section, but we're going to talk about how Paul and I are turf-related. That's a new subject.
That's right.
New term.
All of that and more on this edition of the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. Hello again, everybody. I'm Paul Zawaska, your host for the Diamond Da Vinci's podcast. And, of course, joining us today, as usual, Teresa Beyer, my talented co-host and producer of the show. Good morning, Teresa.
Good morning, Paul. I'm why we can't have nice things.
What?
Well, since I spilled the coffee all over my computer this morning.
Perhaps you need a sippy cup.
I think I do. The good news is I have plenty of them around the house.
There you go. Yeah. Just pick any one laying around there. You could replace the juice with the coffee.
That's right. Perfect.
Well, you know, it's almost the 4th of July.
Yeah.
And so we're about at the halfway point of the baseball season for the pros, at least. But a lot of the amateur and youth leagues are coming up to the end of their seasons. They're winding down. Of course, college is, I think the College World Series is going on right as we speak. Or almost over.
Yeah.
So a lot of the fields are going to start becoming silent. My little league complex, we've got, 3 weeks left of our spring summer season, and then we'll be shutting down. So, and we get about 4 to 5 weeks of open time, or when we shut down the fields, we get about 4 to 5 weeks of time to do any of our renovations that we need to do before fall ball starts in the last week of August. So, and it's really the only time during the actual growing season when we actually get a chance to do work on our fields, that's not bothered by games every day or anything like that. So
now is that kind of problematic because it's during the heat of the summer?
You know, it's not surprisingly. And maybe it's because we're so far north up here in Madison. But
transition zone might struggle a little bit more with that.
Yeah, but it's funny because the first thing that I do as soon as the games are over on the fields, the first thing is I'll do is I aerify all the infields and foul territories before I start worrying about the other stuff, and I just turn the water on and I drown these fields, because what happens is you're being very protective of how much water you put on the field during the season, because you don't want to put too much on to the point where it might do more damage when they're playing. And if you haven't had regular rains, now this year we've had regular rains. I haven't even had to irrigate this year.
Oh, wow.
Which has really been a luxury because we're still dealing with a manual.
You're going to get hate mail from California.
Yeah. but it's funny because when I go in there and I drown those fields that first week, it's amazing how much recuperation occurs in that time.
Isn't that remarkable? I love when you get a good drenching rain, or when you get a chance to really put the spurs to it. It makes a huge difference. And you don't think about that because, you think about the roots being in the top so many inches, but it really does make a difference.
Well, and a lot of times, because the next thing that we do is we prep for sod. We'll sod anywhere between 5,000 and 10,000 square feet every year at that time, between our three fields and the common areas. And a lot of times when I do that soaking, it'll cut down on the amount that I have to sod because the grass just spreads incredibly fast.
Nice.
You know, like it's been starving for water and it's been building up nutrients and it just needs that water to get it to go.
Yeah.
And it really is amazing just how thick suddenly the grass gets and how much it spreads in that short time.
Yeah, that plus you've taken the major wear stress off of it too, and so it gets a chance to really rebound, which is nice.
Right. So, you know, in that, it's not like you asked, is it problematic? No. The problem is do I have enough time to get all done? Like this year, we've got, as usual, we'll aerify all three fields plus some of the common areas. We'll prep and lay for about 5,000 to 8,000 square feet of sod. We reslope all of our mounds. We renovate all the home plate areas. We level every one of the infield skins. We've got this year we got a major playground construction project that we are involved in some areas of the project that will take us away from the fields. We've got some artificial turf trapezoids we've got to put in front of two of the three fields' main mounds. We've got to edge all the tracks and re-level the tracks. So that's just, a good chunk of what we got to do in 5 weeks. And it's amazing that we get all that done. But it's funny because of the time of the season that it is, by the time we get to opening day for fall ball, our fields are in the best condition they are all year. Because we airfy and overseed right off the bat, the 20th, this year it'll be the 20th of July, which for most people would say, well, that's kind of hot, isn't it? But it always works great for us. Yeah. And so we go in, we pull cores, and we aerify. So that seed's got 5 weeks to come up and get established before anybody plays on it again.
That's great.
So by the time we get to fall ball, that field is just thick with grass. Mm-hmm. And it's always our best, the opening of fall ball is always when our fields look their absolute best because of that. So
that's great.
So it's an intense period of the year, but, that's the time of year that you've got to go in and do this work, especially for ball fields, because our season starts so early. I don't care what level you're at.
Mm-hmm.
You're coming out of winter and you don't know how late winter's going to go. You don't know how soft fields are going to be. The only thing you know for sure is the coaches and everybody's going to be on your rear end to hurry up and get those fields in action. So groundskeepers have to take, advantage of these, of this period of the year to do as much work as they can, because it's just easier.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and it was, you and I were discussing all of this stuff and realizing that it's so easy to get caught up in what's going on right now that we forget to plan ahead. And that's why we wanted to bring about the Diamond Da Vinci's maintenance calendar. Or again, please, if you've got a better name, email us. But let's move into that segment.
Yeah.
And, talk about what we've got coming up on the calendar. What are we headed into? You're headed into fall ball. We've got football guys that are thinking about training camp. And our university guys are in the middle of, summer camps, which I'm sure is always fun.
As are the soccer people.
Soccer people, absolutely.
Not to mention regular soccer season is going on as well. Although there's always a soccer season going on. I don't care what time of the year it is.
Yeah. Somebody always wants to play soccer. I don't know what is up with those guys.
Yeah, they can't seem to decide on a season. But the point is that, there's a lot of stuff going on here.
It's worse than
there's
NASCAR.
But there's the big transition coming on between the summer sports and the fall sports.
That's right.
So, guys who are working in schools and universities, they're torn between, I got to get this, the baseball field set up, but at the same time, I got to get that ready for next spring. But at the same time, I got football going. I got to paint football, and painting football takes a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Although, sadly, we're seeing more and more of the college fields going to artificial turf. To a certain extent that I can understand that, but it's sad to see when it happens.
I don't know. I don't remember my university putting on that many different events, but I guess it's different at every university level or every college level,
Yeah.
So let's start on the maintenance calendar. Hit us, Paul.
Yeah. So, what I want to do is I'll cover more of the areas of cultural practices like the aerification and that kind of stuff. We're going to let Teresa carry the chemical end of it, whether it's fertilizers or diseases or things like that she's good at. But, if you're up in the north here right now, in the northern part of the country, again, your youth leagues are getting done. And I just went through a whole slew of things that I'm getting ready to do. And this is, you know, even though the show's being done at the beginning of July, we're talking about the August timeframe right now to give you time to start planning, plan your purchasing and that kind of stuff. So you've got, you know, fall is going to be your overseeding period and late August, especially up here in the north. So you're starting to look at your what are you going to be buying for seed for overseeding, the quality of the material, what are the prices these days, you know, the new crops coming in, what's available, what's not, what's in tight supply. Sometimes, I mean, I hate to be a hoarder, but if I know certain supplies are tight, I'm going to hoard some seed. You know, if I know I'm going to use it up over the course of the next year, you know, sure. I'll buy it all at once if I know that the source is short.
Yeah.
So it's always good to talk to your seed dealer and find out what's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
Making sure your aerification equipment is ready to go, those kind of things. Yeah, I'll start aerifying typically now because of our schedule. They're a little complex. I have to do it earlier than I would like to, but it's always worked out for us, thank God, knock on wood. But normally, guys are looking at late August, early September up here in the north of getting some good, serious aerification in if football schedules aren't getting in their way.
Yeah, and that's still a little too early for a lot of the guys in the south.
No, absolutely. It is too early. Yeah.
Well, and by the south, I mean the transition zone. When you get into the deep south, now we've moved into warm season grasses and parts of California, we've moved into warm season grasses, and that has a whole different schedule. But when we're talking cool season grasses in the transition zone, we're really not looking to do some of those cultural things until we get closer to the end of September, beginning of October. There's a delicate balance of waiting long enough that you have the happiest grass you can have while not waiting so long that it snows.
Yes.
So,
now, the other thing is like myself, there are going to be people who are guided by the scheduled activities on their fields.
Absolutely.
And they may have to go out of the realm of, you know, the optimum timing like I have to do. Fortunately, it's always worked out for me. But now I can say that. But at the same time, there have been several years when I've been hit by rust.
Mm.
Right after I get the fields right up and ready to, in good shape, which isn't quite that debilitating a disease, but
no, but it's a good sign that you've pushed your grass a little too far.
Yep. Yeah. I'd say.
Yeah. Yeah. That you've done something that's just, you know, you've weakened the grass enough during an already stressful period and, you know, or also, you know, there are lots of ways you can get rust, but at that particular time of year and when you're under a strict fertilization regime, that's usually what you'll end up seeing that rust for. You know, a lot of the guys are on some kind of a strobilurin fungicide program where they regularly are putting down either Heritage or Insignia or, you know, if you're not on a fungicide schedule, you do want to keep your eyes open for some of the warm season diseases or, you know, the warm weather diseases. There's not a ton of them, but they're here, you know, every once in a while. Your summer patch is a big one on bluegrasses, and you want to get out there and get your preventative fungicide out as quickly as possible.
Yeah, because at this time of the year, you know, the damage has pretty much been done.
Right.
Even a curative at this time of the year for summer patch is really not worth the money.
Not usually, but sometimes you just want to do something to make sure. Yeah. Your summer patch is something you really have to consider treating ahead of time in the spring. Yeah. But, you know, coming into August, that's when we'll start thinking about some of our cooler season degrees, or cooler season diseases, and that will be your leaf spot and your melting out. Those will pop up again in the fall. Even if you didn't get them in the spring, if you're not watching your fertilization practices closely, you know, you don't want to have too little nitrogen at the same token that you don't want to have too much nitrogen. And you also want to be watering nice and deeply and stretching your roots out as much as possible. That'll help out with the reducing the stress for the grass.
Yes.
Yeah.
On the ball field end of things, again, with fall renovation, this is the time if you've got problems with your infield soils or if you've got problems with lip issues, your lips are too big, this is the time to be taking those lips out, getting the infields regraded. If you don't like the makeup of your soils, get your soils tested because this is the time to go in and amend those soils so they've got time to sit and settle and recongeal, There's such a word.
Well, and it's also a good time to take a soil test where you check to see where your nutrition is. I know Absolutely. A lot of people like to wait until fall to do it, but I always recommend getting it done as we come into the fall, end of July, beginning of August, because you can see what you've depleted over the season, and you can also prepare to make some different additions in the fall, especially if you're working on native soil.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. This is the time for that nutrient test because, like you say, this is when you've depleted it all, and this is when the grass is going to start needing it, building itself up for the winter.
Yeah.
And so you want to make sure you're giving the plant everything it needs. And so the only way to do that is to have it quantitatively
measured,
deduced for you. Yeah, measured. Right?
Well, and while you're doing that, you're taking your samples. You can pop out your cores, and you can see coming into the beginning of August on your cool season grasses, you can see where your roots are. How much have you sloughed? What do you have to work with? Do you need to be thinking about fertilizing more frequently to hit your shallower roots, or did you have better survival than you would have thought? And so you can kind of change your application that way as well.
Or how deep is your thatch layer?
And absolutely.
Do you have to be much more aggressive with your hollow core tining?
Oh boy, yeah.
To pull more plugs to get rid of some of the thatch and to pull more soil up on top to help decrease that thatch layer. So that's another reason for taking those samples and taking a good look at that kind of thing.
Paul, when you do your core your coring, how many passes do you usually make?
Well, when we're doing the infields and foul territories, which typically have the most wear on a ball field, usually if I can, I'll double over those.
Good.
To pull up as much soil as I can, open it up as much as I can. The other thing that I do is if you have a field that's not very smooth, this is the time to roll it. Don't roll it in the spring when it's moist. You don't have a lot. You've got some movement there, but not like right after an aerification. When you aerify a field, you open up a lot of pore space. And when you open up all that pore space, there's more fluidity to that soil. It has more room to move. So top dressing is an important part of leveling a field, but so is aerification and rolling. And so, you know, people will say, well, isn't it counterproductive to aerify and then roll? You're never going to seal up everything that you've done with aerification.
You're but not that powerful, my friend.
but it is the best time to go in and roll that field to try and take out the bumps, any kind of problems that you might have right at the surface. It's not going to cure it all in one shot, but if it's a routine thing that you do every year, that's certainly going to help a lot. So in the outfield, I'll typically go one pass only because of the time I have. Again, remember, I'm doing three fields in a shallow amount of time, and I've got a lot of work to do to these fields.
Mm-hmm.
You know, each of our fields sees over 400 events a year on them, which is phenomenal considering the look of them. And by the way, if you're ever curious to see what the fields look like that I talk about, my Little League fields, if you go onto our website and go on to the bios of the host, you'll see under my bio there's a button there that says Paul's pictures or whatever the heck it says. You click that up and you'll see a lot of some great aerial pictures taken this spring from a drone.
Oh, nice.
Of our Little League fields, and you can see just what I'm talking about. But the other place that I'll make sure, of course, that I'm aerifying heavily is our outfielder areas. Again, we're all native soil fields, so they pack them down. And the thing, you know, with youth sports, the younger kids, they are not allowed to wear metal cleats. And so they're all wearing those rubber cleats that are blunt-ended. And I'm telling you, they're like little tamps. And they can compact like nobody's business.
Mm.
And so you have to get in there on those fields especially. You know, I go around all around the country and I see fields where 12-year-olds and on younger play on these fields and they have giant dead spots in all the outfields. Well, they haven't been kept with aerification. You know, they're not overseeding, they're not sodding. Now, they might not have the money for it or the time for it. That's understandable. But
they've got a million events and there's only so much you can do. But
400 events. Now, granted, I've got a huge budget. You know, my budget is beyond belief.
You are a special situation.
Yes. So, but we didn't, it used to be that way. You know, we used to have nothing and we've built it up to what it is now. And, you know, The more you can do, and with aerification, as far as I'm concerned, there is almost no such thing as too much aerification.
Yep. Yep. And mathematically, that bears out as well. Standard setup for a drum aerifier, if you've got quarter inch hollow tines, you pull that across the field one time, you're maybe going to disturb 5% of the total area.
And typically, it
depends on the setup and the math, but around 5%.
Yeah, in bluegrass, I prefer to use a 3/4 inch or a 1 inch tine, if at all possible.
Did I say a quarter inch? I meant 3/4 inch.
You said quarter. You meant 3/4. I know what you meant. But
sorry about that. Thank you.
Yeah. Now, if I'm on a Bermuda field, I would probably go more with a 1/2 inch tine, just because it's a finer textured and very short cut,
mm-hmm.
whereas it's more well hidden with the taller grass.
You can do both. We've certainly done 3/4 inch on the Bermuda, no problem. In fact, the lovely thing about Bermuda grass in July and August is that you can beat the crap out of it and tomorrow it'll look fine.
But that's true with any grass. You know, the more you beat it up, the better it's going to come out in the long haul.
Cultivation-wise, yes. Yeah.
Depending on the weather, of course.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. Take it all carefully. Yep. Well, great. Well, from there... Let's go talk to Roger Bossert, see what he has to say today.
But first, let's have a word from our sponsor. It's the dog days of summer and time to start getting your ducks in a row for your late summer or fall ball field renovation work. And the first thing you want to think about is whether or not your infield skin is working for you. Is it too hard or too soft, too dusty or too greasy? Is your infield skin low and need more material added to it? Now, in the past, most groundskeepers just guessed what an infill soil needed and hoped for the best, but not anymore. You can't fix something if you don't know what's wrong with it in the first place. And that's especially true with infield soils. One of the best investments you can make on your ball field is to have your infield soils tested so you know what's in it and where the potential problems are. Beacon Athletics was one of the first to offer infield soil testing back in the 1990s and has over 20 years' experience in infield soil analysis and troubleshooting. We can pinpoint the source of your infield skin woes and present a strategy to correct for any issues. We also offer DuraEdge and FieldSaver engineered infield soils, which are computer-blended for precise specifications. Start preparing now for the renovation season by submitting your 1-quart infield soil sample to us. Call us at Beacon Athletics at 800-747-5985 for more information on infield soil testing. Stop guessing about your infield soils and get the facts. And today's Out of the Park segment is celebrating the 80-year multi-generational contributions that the Bossert family has made to the baseball groundskeeping world and Major League Baseball. Starting with Emil Bossert joining the Cleveland Indians at League Park in Cleveland in 1936, there have been at least one or more Bosserts minding a major league ball field ever since, and that is quite an accomplishment. With us today is the third generation of the Bossert's groundskeeping group that is minding a major league field, and that's Roger Bossert, the longtime head groundskeeper for the Chicago White Sox. So welcome, Roger.
Well, thanks, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here. I wish I could say that we are in first place right now while we're having this conversation. However, you know how baseball goes, and hopefully in the next couple of weeks, the Chicago White Sox are going to be getting a little bit better and going up in the standings.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about sports is there's always next year or, you know, at this point, it's still early in the season. And actually, it's interesting because my son and I were just talking about it recently, about how a lot of the divisions in baseball this year are fairly evenly matched. You know, there's not any one team that's really blowing people out of the water.
I agree with you there. It's good for baseball. It's good for the game. You know, when they've made the changes over the last, 10, 15 years, when Bud Selig made all the changes as far as the different teams playing and which division and all the umpires now, everybody's together, and all the changes that have been made in baseball really been a positive. There's no question about it.
And funny that there were people at the time who would not be too thrilled about the changes, but you're right. The changes have, I think, really improved the game in a lot of different ways. So that's great. Roger, I could sit here and tell the story, but if you wouldn't mind it in a nutshell, giving the family history, starting with your grandfather, Emil, and who all's been through the ranks of Major League Baseball, in the Bossert family real quick. I'll let you tell the story since you're part of it.
Okay. Okay. You know, it did start, I guess, obviously around, I don't know, it was 1927 or 28, I guess, when Emo, he had the family. They were in St. Paul, Minnesota, and he was the head groundkeeper in St. Paul. And he was maintaining a field there, and there was somebody from the Cleveland Indians that was, I don't know if they lived in the area or they were in the area. And anyways, they liked what he did. And so they invited him to go, and I guess, in the early or the mid-1930s to Cleveland. So he packed everybody up and went to Cleveland. And of course, it was Grandpa, Grandma, and his three sons, Harold, Marshall, and my dad, Gene. In 1941, the general manager of the White Sox had called Grandpa and said, I'd like to have one of your sons come up here and be the head groundkeeper here. For whatever reason, and I actually don't know why, my dad was never explicit about that to me, but Harold and Marshall, which were the two older boys, did not want to go. So, a dad at 23 years old came up here to Chicago and was the head groundkeeper. And even to today, there's no one that's even close to that. I mean, to be, Paul, you were head groundkeeper for many years. I mean, it's hard to imagine being a head groundkeeper at 23 years old.
Oh, yeah,
especially coming to Chicago, you know, with a young wife. And my sister was a little baby at that time. It started then. And dad came here in 1940. And he retired in 83. I started here in 67, took over, obviously, when Dad retired. In the meantime, there was Harold and Marshall in Cleveland, and I think it was, I don't know if it was 68, 69, somewhere around there, where Grandpa had retired, and then Harold and Marshall took over. And I think both of them ended up retiring, I don't know if it was the late 70s, maybe middle late 70s, something like that. And I've been here now, of course, this is my 49th year I've been in Major League Baseball. And
That's a long time.
Yes, and then, of course, there's Brian. He's the sixth one. Brian was my cousin, of course, and he was the head groundkeeper with the San Diego Padres in the 70s for, I think, 7 years. And then he left there and went to the New York Yankees as the head groundkeeper. He was there for only a year and a half. And he was at my Uncle Harold's house, walking up the basement stairs, and had a massive heart attack and died on the spot at 42.
Oh, my goodness.
there were six of us, and I think, you know, I haven't totaled up for a while, but I know it used to be over 225 years that the six of us have. And,
oh, my gosh.
The family in Major League Baseball. And I get, you know, I guess I was Kid Rob Ventura, and he, every once in a while, he and I talk about it, joke around. I said, you know what? We've been tricking a lot of people for a long time in baseball. But I've got to tell you what, I've loved every minute of it. I suppose, you know, and I apologize if I'm going on here, but there's actually only been one day that I've actually regretted, and a lot of people probably don't know about this day, but we had what was called disco demolition when the late Bill Veeck was here. And
that was a time when
yeah, it wasn't good. And I can remember looking my dad in the face then and going, you know, I'm not quite sure if I went in the right direction. And when, you know, in between games, when you see a bonfire in the middle of the field and kids are pulling up the bases and home plate and the mound, it certainly was it was a negative for the groundkeeper. But I've got to say, I love what I do. I actually wouldn't change what I do. I am doing exactly what I want to do in life. And there are very few people that I've looked in the face that have been able to tell that to me.
Yeah, you know, it's funny because my son is in turf school right now. He's going through Penn State's online program, but he's working at our Little League complex. And he's been working there with me for 6-7 years now. I forget how long it's been. But he went and interned with Nicole out in Baltimore last year.
Oh, okay.
And after he came back, he's not so sure that, you know, Major League Baseball is where he wants to be. He likes baseball, but, you know, he saw the demand that it is there. And it, like I said, it's even worse now than it was before because, you know, when I was in it, we didn't have as many of these extracurricular activities in between homestands.
Yeah, that makes a huge difference.
And that makes a huge difference because there's no chance for the groundskeepers to recharge their batteries.
Well, no, and you know what you bring up? That's certainly a great point. I know David Miller in Boston, actually one of the top groundkeepers in baseball, and I think he has over 75 events. Larry DeVito, another top groundkeeper in Minnesota. I turned my ESPN on a week ago, and I see that he has four games a day. They're playing college baseball there.
And then you didn't get to see that they did high school baseball the week after that.
That's great. You know what? I have like over 42 extra events here, but when you start doing all that kind of stuff, I'm glad they don't hold all that here because I'm not that. That's sort of crazy. But you know, there's a lot of a lot of positives. The STMA, which started, I don't know, 18 or 20 years ago, they certainly have done an awful lot for some of the young groundkeepers. Have they helped with everything? No, not by any stretch. However, they helped the young groundkeeper and realize, and you can talk to other people now. You know, years ago, some of the old timers didn't want to make a phone call, didn't want the other guy to know, well, I actually don't know about this disease or what chemical to use. Where now, with the STMA coming on board, they've opened it up for the people. And I think that is just so good. And I know they've got their own website. If you got a problem, you can go on that. I think if there's one negative factor, and I'm being very candid about this, in Major League Baseball right now, there's a lot of the owners it's not family anymore. I'm fortunate we've got family here. Jerry Reinsdorf is just a tremendous guy, and it's family. With a lot of the ownership groups now, the groundkeeper isn't held to the hierarchy that he was 20 years ago.
That's right.
And it's a shame, and I hate to say that, but I'm one of the old timers. I can make this statement. Yeah, it is. And
it's absolutely true.
Yeah, and it's terrible to say that, but the pay scale of some of the major league groundkeepers isn't, at least in my opinion, in many people's opinion, isn't what it's supposed to be, not considering the hours and the pressure you've got on you.
Right.
But it is what it is. And once again, it's a corporate thing, and I get it. It's, in other words, if you don't want to be the head groundkeeper and make X amount, we'll get another guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's always somebody willing to do it.
Yeah,
whether they can do a good job or not is
that's exactly correct. I've been blessed here with Jerry Reinsdorf, and you know it's Bill Veeck years ago once said that a real good groundkeeper is worth 8 to 10 games. My family has never believed that. I think that's a little bit of a stretch, but I believe a real good groundkeeper is worth 4 to 6, and it's not just the tricks of the trade. But I guess the main thing, and Paul, I know you can certainly appreciate this, without question, the most important part of the field is where? It's the infield clay. And that area, that arena, if you will, is what makes or breaks a groundkeeper. Rule of thumb is, the way I've been brought up, is if you can go a year, this is from Grandpa, if you can go a year and only have 4 or 5 bad hops, you'd have a tremendous season. And I don't think there's a whole lot of groundkeepers that can go a year without having 4 or 5 bad hops. And that's very difficult, whether it's me or anybody else. But you have to take care of your team. Each position is different, the watering procedures. I've been fortunate enough that when I've designed and built a lot of the other major league fields, part of my program is I have the head groundkeeper come and work with me for a few days to understand the clay area, exactly what needs to be done, what type of material. You have to remember there's 14 different types of infield material that can be used as far as soil conditioners. There's 14,000 different types of soil structures in the United States. There's only 10% that are conducive to infield soils. And Paul, you being one of the experts in that industry, can appreciate that. If the groundkeeper orders the wrong clay, he literally is screwed.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it makes the work that much harder for him throughout the entire season.
No question. And at the major league level, this is where the game has changed. I was talking a little bit earlier, and once again, I apologize if I'm going on here and boring you with some of the stuff. But
not at all.
This is the area where the game has changed. If you do have a bad hop now and you're head groundkeeper, you will hear about it.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, years ago, you wouldn't hear about it the way they do now. Literally now, players is going to make it well known to everybody they got a bad hop. So that puts, and once again, that's part of life. That's part of the job. That's part of the industry. But it makes it hard on the groundkeeper, and it's difficult to go home at night and someone's complaining to you. So the infield area, that arena, is without question the most important. And I've got to be honest, I've got the smallest crew in baseball. I've got myself and three people. And oh,
that's a small crew.
Yeah.
It is. And it's the way I was raised. You know, yeah. I'm the guy, I can look at my hands right now, and I have the blisters on the hands. No one wets my infield dirt. No one but me. That's the way I was raised. And I guess, once again, I've been tricking it for a while, so evidently it's been working. But that's how important it is. And I do feel that, once again, being an old-timer, being around for a number of years, if there was one area where the young groundkeeper really would have to learn and put more expertise into, it's understanding the clay soil cavity.
Absolutely.
There are people in our industry that, I don't know, geez, I've heard terms. People are what, the clay gods, the guru of dirt, and da-da-da-da. And I sometimes question that. I have the clay on my infield. Here's a great story. I have the clay that my dad had in the 1950s. Dad, my father was the first one to start with soil conditioners in 1960. There were two guys, a guy by the name of Nellie Fox and Billy Pierce, that my dad was real close to. A fellow by the name of Frank Smith came to him. I'm going to back up just a minute here. Said, I want you to try this stuff. It was, the company was called Wyandotte. Dad started it in 1960.
I recognize that name,
yeah.
Yes, and Dad was the first one to use soil conditioner. A lot of people don't know that. He was the first one in the history of the game to use soil conditioner. And there are some fine, fine products out there now. But I guess what I just want to get at is with the young groundkeeper, sometimes they don't get what type of conditioners to use. I use three different types. You have to remember that, and I do a lot of consulting for other major league teams, and a lot of times I'll get calls from groundkeepers going, I'm losing my solidification, my cementation on the infield. I go, is the conditioner you're using having a lot of fines in it? And they go, you know what it does. Over a period of time, if you lose too many fines, that fine coagulates into that little particle structure of clay, and it breaks it down. If you use a medium-sized calcined clay, it will not break that clay down because of the clay itself. It's a larger particle. Clay adheres to clay. I use three different particle structures depending on how my field is during the year. And certainly maybe taking it to another level, it's the way I was raised.
Yeah.
And it's what I do. And I've been tricking them for a long time.
You know, Pat Sanron used to say, this is the easiest job in the world if it wasn't for that tarp. That's what he always used to say.
You know what? Oh, how man. True. You know what? I was the guy that I did the field in Arizona and also out in Seattle and Milwaukee. I designed and built those fields. And I got to tell you, there's many times when I talk to the groundkeepers there and tell them, you don't know how fortunate you are when you press that button and 11 minutes later, that baby's closed. Yeah. So I can appreciate exactly where you're coming from. But it's been good. I'm babbling on here. Go ahead.
Your grandfather, especially, was somebody who actually trained and his sons trained some pretty big names in major league groundskeeping over the years. For instance, your grandfather was the teacher to George Toma.
Yes, that's true.
And a lot of the younger generation, you know, one of the things I like to do with this show is teach the younger generation about the history of our business. And, a lot of people don't know that Toma was actually trained by Emil Bossert.
Yeah, I know Grandpa, and once again, years ago, I know Grandpa had mentioned George's name a couple times at the table. He loved George. He loved his work ethic. And I think Grandpa always saw George as almost like a Bossert because of the fact that there was never a time during the day if something had to be done where you go, well, I'll get it tomorrow or I'll get it next week. And I actually don't, you know, when I was in the industry, Georgia actually didn't have natural turf. I don't know, you know, but I understand that when he did that, his fields were really good. I understand that Georgia was an excellent, excellent baseball groundkeeper and certainly a tremendous football groundkeeper. I mean, what he did for the NFL was just him and Jim Watson. I mean, those two together were just what they did was just tremendous. They changed the industry around for the
NFL. They changed
the
image. They changed the image of the groundskeeper. They helped change the image of the groundskeepers too. Yeah.
No question. No question.
But again, that all has its roots back again in a Bossert. You know, you've got like I mentioned, we had Tom Burns on the last show, the former Texas Rangers groundskeeper. He and along with Mark Razum, the current Rockies groundskeeper, again were mentored, and they had more amazing things to say about Marshall and Harold 2 weeks ago than I expected coming out of them, and they gushed about how great they were. And Tom said, you know, Marshall, he said if nobody knew more about infield dirt than Marshall did that he had met, and he was so impressed with. So, you know, there's some really interesting tie-ins to current groundskeepers back to the Bossert family.
Well, you know, I appreciate those kind words. Once again, it's this what we're doing right now is it's certainly making me reminisce back to the days when Grandpa and my uncles and we were all together for the birthdays or the Christmases. It was the fun times, and once again, I've been blessed to have those genes. I love what I do. I would not change what I do.
Now, let me ask this, Roger. Do you feel that your destiny was predetermined growing up?
Yeah, you know what? I went to Purdue, but I remember when I was probably 10, 11 years old, I was your typical, I hung around the park all the time in the summer.
You Stadium rat was what we used to call them.
yeah. I mean, that was me. Although when I was 10 or 11, I wasn't doing a nail drag. I was riding around in the carts flying up and down the ramps of the stands. But I remember those days. And yeah, I pretty much, I often tell that to people that I actually, when I was 10 or 11, you don't know what you're going to do when you're 10 or 11. Right. However, being out here as much as I was, it was almost predestined. And although I've got to tell you that I can remember my dad telling me, Roger, you know, if you want to go in another direction, he had no problem. Once again, it's a father with his son. You know, you want your best. You want what's best for your kids. And I said, you know what? Well, I think let me try it out here and let me see what happens. And here I am 49 years later. So it's all good. It's all good.
Yeah. If you had one piece of advice to give to the modern day groundskeepers or kids who are looking to get into the business or kids who are just starting in the business, what would you say would be the key piece of Bossert knowledge that you would like to pass on to young groundskeepers?
You know, it's probably not
it's hard
one
to narrow it down
I
to one thing.
Yeah, it is. I don't know if I can make it a singular thing, but you know, there's an old saying that satisfaction is the first step towards defeat. You can't ever be satisfied. You can always be better. And I actually was raised by Dad that you actually strive for that. You want to be the best. You know, let me say this, and Paul, you can appreciate this. A lot of life is who you know. An awful lot of life
Absolutely.
Is who you know. And you know, there's some, I mean, we've got some great young groundkeepers in the industry now, just some really, really good ones. You need to know the right person. You have to start at that Class A level. And one of the things that has bothered me in the past, and that's a good question that you've asked me, is I usually average 8 to 10 calls a day from groundkeepers all over, whether it's a problem with the grass or the dirt or the soil structure or whatever. And one of the things, every once in a while I'll get a call, and the problem they had is, you know, a month old. You know, they have brown patch and the whole field's taken over, or pythium. And I'll go, why didn't you call earlier? And they would go, I didn't want to call earlier because I didn't want you to think I didn't know. And gosh, I feel so sorry for the kids. And I guess that would be the one thing I'd relate. You have to strive for perfection. You can't you can't achieve it. But also, you've got to remember, the wisest man is the one who knows what he doesn't know.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting that.
The wisest man is the one who knows what he doesn't know and make a phone call. And that's some of the young groundskeepers. And Paul, in the business you're in, you run into guys calling you all the time.
All the time. Yep.
Yeah. And sometimes you just sort of, you go, you should have called me a month ago, 2 months ago. Make phone calls. I've got some very close friends that are plant pathologists. I have no problems calling them up if I got a disease or something that I feel that I don't know. I'm trying to be a wise man, but being a wise man, you've got to make sure and call other people. You've got to surround yourself with good people. Yes. That is what I would tell the good young groundkeepers. Don't be afraid to ask questions and get to know the guys much better. And once again, you look for people to open the doors, and that's all part of it.
And, you know, unlike the old days where the secrets were kept within, today's groundskeepers, like, I love when people call and ask me a question because they don't know what to do. One thing I love doing, it's teaching the craft to people and teaching. I just love it.
No question. I mean, it's all out there. I mean, with the STMA, I covered a little bit earlier what they're doing for everybody. It's all out there. But that, and also if you're a baseball groundkeeper, if you want to get ahead, learn clay real quick. Yep. And you have to learn from the right people. Sometimes, and I'm not going to talk on this much, sometimes some of the articles that are put out are not accurate. So go to somebody.
There's somebody's opinion.
Thank you. And I don't want to get into that. But go to somebody that actually does it, not somebody that's giving you a right, that's giving you their opinion, that's never done it for the big boys. You got to do it for the big boys before you really know what to do. Pick a head groundkeeper, major league head groundkeeper's brain, and he'll help you out much quicker than sometimes reading an article by somebody that's actually never done it.
Well, and even the minor league guys too. I mean, if you've got somebody who's happily in and doing well in the minor leagues for 10, 15, 20 years, some of those guys are working on some really bad conditions, and that teaches them a lot.
No question about it. No, yeah, I mean, you're absolutely correct. I mean, some of the minor league teams, I mean, obviously everybody's under the, you know, financial burden these mm-hmm. days, whether it's minor or major leagues, but the minor leagues especially, they don't have a ton of conditioners sitting in the back room, and they don't have 20 ton of sand when they just want to go in top dress and stuff like that. No, I agree, but it's out there. As Paul had stated, it's out there between the STMA. It's just a matter of go ahead, make a call, and find out.
Yeah.
It's really, really easy. Just picking up the phone.
When I was in turf school in the early 80s, there was very little out there written and, you know, about baseball groundskeeping, because the STMA was just starting at the time. I joined the STMA in 82 when it was just coming on.
Sure.
I was one of the original people who got onto the organization. There was nothing written at that time, and you couldn't find stuff. Now there's tons of material out there, and so it's so much easier for these people to find these answers.
I agree. Yeah. And I, you know what, whenever I talk at turf conferences, I always tell people, and actually some of them are actually surprised that I say it, but I actually mean it. If anyone ever has a question, call me. I am one of those people. I do return phone calls. There are some people in our industry that don't do that. I think that they're in their mind, they're beyond that. They're a little bit better than everybody. I'm not one of those. If you want to call me, give me a buzz. I'll return phone calls.
So what does Roger Bossard do when he's not groundskeeping? What do you do in your spare time to loosen up, let go, relax, enjoy? Are you a fisherman? Are you, do you paint? Do you read?
I would love it if you were a painter. That would be great.
This is Roger Bossard. When I wake up in the morning, I've got a little Italian wife. You know, I'm up and I'm ready to go. When she's, will you settle down a little bit? Just go to sleep for another 20 minutes. That's me. I don't drink any coffee. I could never do that. I'm one of those people that, I'm not going to say I'm wired all the time, but to settle down, I do golf a little bit. My wife and I, we're very fortunate. We have a home up in Michigan, and every once in a while when I'm able to get away, we'll go there. It's on the lake, and just take a walk along the lake. I'm very active in jogging. I do jog at least 1 to 2 miles every day. So that keeps me going. And my son Brandon's a junior in high school, and he plays a lot of ball. So when a club's out of town, I like to go watch him. But I definitely am not a fisherman. I certainly could not sit there waiting for that fish to bite on that line. that isn't me. You know what? I have my health. My family has their health, and I'm doing what I love. I mean, does it get better?
That's right. I mean, if you love what you do, you don't need anything else. You really don't.
A job is 60% of your life. You better like it.
Yeah. Pardon me for asking. How old are you now?
I'm in my 60s.
How many years do you think old Roger Bossert has left in him?
You know, it's up to God.
Yeah?
Yeah. Probably another 4 years. I don't know, maybe another 5.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know.
You're not at the point where you sit back and go, oh, you know, I'm about ready to just get the hell
no,
out of here.
In fact, you know, it's funny. Every once in a while I'm asked that, and I actually never give a thought.
Yep.
To be honest, I mean, once again, I the Lord's been good to me. I've got my health. I love what I do. I love my wife. And I'm, you know what, for some reason, I think that if I would retire and she had to look at me 24 hours a day, I don't know if she'd love me that much anymore. So
I've had that same thought about my husband.
No, I'm happy where I'm at. Certainly, you know, the long hours, as you get a little bit older, the long hours, they play with you a little bit more. But and it's not a financial thing. I'm not the richest person in the world, but I'm happy where I'm at. Yeah, I like what I do. My life doesn't get better than right now. I'm very happy.
You'll eventually leave the ballpark, but maybe still continue your consulting work?
Yeah, you know what? Dad hung on for another 2 or 3 years. Once again, I've got the company. And, you know, I'm building fields all the time, designing and building fields all the time. And so, I mentioned earlier that Brandon will probably take that over. And so I'd probably be more inclined to go with the company, to be honest with you. I enjoy designing and building fields because, in my opinion, there aren't too many people that know what they're doing out there. And so I like it. It's when you do something like that, especially at a major league facility, it's special. And you want to make it right. And it's always a challenge. I mean, you know, when I did Milwaukee, it was in January and February.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Seattle, we had, I was there for 75 days and 73 of them, it was raining. I mean, it's a challenge.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm, Paul, to answer your question, I'm very happy where I'm at. I have no complaints.
So do you prefer the construction side or do you prefer the maintenance side?
I actually like the construction.
Really? That's cool.
Yeah, I really do. You know, because you've got to remember that there are some people out there, designers out there, that in my opinion, there's three things. It's hard for someone that has never maintained a field to design it.
And
the reason why I make
that
statement is that when you're constructing a field, there are times when you're on site and you go, I want to put one more drain line in. I'm not comfortable with this area here. Or, you know what? I mean, I'm a big believer in non-organic. I use pure sand for the sand base cavity. People like organic. I don't. Half the fields in baseball now are non-organic, and I know 12 of them for sure because I've done it. the plant builds its own organic up.
That's correct.
This is me, of course. I mean, you know, this is a Purdue man and the way I've been raised, and I built the first natural field here in 1991 of pure sand. And I remember at the time, a lot of my peers from Purdue and people from the USGA, I do a lot with the USGA also, a lot of people here going, Roger, you're taking a hell of a risk. It has to have organic. And I said, I've been testing this for 2 years, actually 2.5 years. And the plant dies down, a bluegrass plant, the feeder roots will die down twice a year. that helps build up your organic down. Over a 10-year period of time, if you go back and you see fields that have a 90-10 mix in it, all of a sudden the organic is going down to the 3-inch depth because of the roots dying off with the organic down there has accumulated together.
And I'm a root sloughing.
Exactly. A lot of people that sit at a desk that have never been major league head groundkeepers or construction people don't get it. So in the meantime, if the field is built bad, designed and built bad, you know who suffers? The groundkeeper.
Absolutely.
And that's not fair. I am a groundkeeper. And this is a I could talk forever on this, and I'm not going to, but this is a big big boogaloo for me that people that should be designing are, and they have the ability, they have the God-given ability to the people that sit with the suits of making them believe that they know what they do. And then at the end of the day, the groundkeeper is very dissatisfied, but there's nothing he can do. They go, here's the field you've got. And it's not right. Yeah. So, so that's the construction philosophy of Roger Bosford.
But you know, it makes absolute sense because it was the same thing when we built Oriel Park, which you know I always felt sorry for you because we built Oriel Park right after you guys opened your.
Oh,
park.
I know.
And we had all these, you know, throwback things that we put into our park, and I remember back then thinking, oh, I feel sorry because you guys opened the year before, and I thought to myself, I knew what was coming, and I said, oh, I'm going to feel sorry for these guys next year after we open our park because they're going to wish they had waited a year or two more to hopefully take on some of the stuff that we had done. But anyways, you know, when we were dealing with the designing our ballpark, we fought tooth and nail with our architects, them trying to tell us what to do. And I remember Pat and I being in meetings with these guys just arguing over the size of the drains and the dugouts. They wanted to put these pretty little tiny drains in the dugouts.
Right.
No, we need big, massive drains. Well, guess what? They ended up with those little tiny things with these nice brass plates on. And what do you see in the baseball bloopers for the first 2 years of Oriel Park? You kept seeing our dugouts flooding. And because our dugouts would flood, we several times had our bat storage flood, which was, you know, that's $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in bats every time it flooded.
Right.
And the clubhouse, you know, and because the architects wouldn't listen to us because they knew better than we did. And it frustrated the hell out of Pat and I.
I know. It's amazing that your people would listen to these people. They wouldn't listen to you.
Exactly.
Yeah, I understand. I agree. I like I say, I can go on and on, but we won't do that.
Well, Roger, I really appreciate you taking the time today to talk about some of the history. The Bosford name is looms large in Major League Baseball, and a lot of people have come from that training over the years, some big names and some not so big names, but that's not the important part. It's what the influence that the Bosford name and the Bosford family has had to this industry over the past 80 plus years, and we hope it keeps on for quite a while longer, and we appreciate you taking your time today.
Well, Paul, you know what, Paul and Therese, I tell you what, this turned out, I really appreciate you calling me, and it's my pleasure to do this, and if you ever need anything again, please don't hesitate to call me. I'd be glad to do it.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and have a great rest of the season, Roger.
Hey, thanks, Paul. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
For all of you Diamond Da Vinci's out there who are busy this time of year painting your fields, whether it's for baseball, soccer, or the upcoming football season, Beacon Athletics can help you complete your on-field masterpieces. We have a full offering of string lines, stencils, templates, paint machines, and paint. Beacon can provide custom field stencils to promote your organization, club, or school. Then, to paint it, we offer various bulk paints like Beacon's own Dazzaline, or try the likes of World Class or Combi Premium paints with many vibrant colors available. For touch-ups, we also have World Class and Goal Line brand aerosol turf paints. To apply your bulk paints, Beacon carries the top-of-the-line Graco Field Laser S100 or the Powerliner 850 Airless Line Sprayers. These gas-powered machines can handle the big jobs, but for the smaller jobs, we also have the battery-powered Field Laser S90 and the Combi. So let your creative imagination run wild. Check our web store at www.beaconathletics.com or call our experienced sales staff at 800-747-5985 and let us help you with your brushes, paint, and palette to bring your masterpieces to life.
Paul, when you started that conversation with Roger, he was talking about where his family got started from and how they got involved in everything, and he was talking about his grandfather, starting in Cleveland, and then his father moving to Chicago. It was kind of interesting to me. My family is from Cleveland, and my family is also in turf. I didn't know that for the longest time. When I was in the middle of my degree at Kentucky, I was talking with my grandparents, and I found out that my great-grandfather was actually they didn't call it a groundskeeper. They didn't call it a superintendent at the time. He was the golf pro. And so I'd always thought of it as golf pro. And so there I was in the middle of my degree thinking, this is awesome. I'm the first member of my family to be doing something totally cool and different, right? I'm the one in the history book that's blazing a path and going someplace new. And no, it turns out that my great-grandfather, the golf pro, used to build golf courses and then would maintain them as a superintendent would, while also providing professional golf services and running the pro shop. Things have drastically changed in golf, obviously. But he was still known as the club golf pro. And mm-hmm. it was fascinating to me to learn more about this, although I was kind of bummed not to be the trailblazer.
How's that going for you now?
Yeah, right? It was also kind of interesting to think, oh my gosh, is this love of what I do, is this genetic? Or, where did this come from?
Sure.
And so I started tracing him back and learning more about where he had been. Well, he'd built golf courses all over the Midwest, in the Chicago area, in the Cleveland area, in Massillon, Ohio, I think in Columbus, too, if I remember offhand, Janesville, Wisconsin. And I found out also in Madison, Wisconsin. And so you had just moved up to Madison or moved back to Madison a little while ago, and I was in school and I was working on a trip up to Madtown, and just wanted to get up there and talk to some of the guys at UW for turf things. And
UW, I'm guessing, is short for University of Wisconsin.
Oh my gosh, did I offend you?
I have never heard anybody call my college UW.
The rest of the world does.
UW maybe, but
UW. UW? Oh, come on. Sorry. University of Wisconsin. Where everybody is awesome and all things are great. But you and I were having a phone conversation, and we talked before how you and I ended up as mentor and mentee, and I was telling you all this new stuff I had learned about my great-grandfather, and I said, hey, while I'm there, I want to visit a golf course that my great-grandfather built. And you said, oh, yeah, that's really interesting. And I told you the name of the golf course. And I can't remember if you actually fell out of your chair or or if it just seemed like
certainly
it.
Certainly the jaw dropped.
Yeah, because turns out that my great-grandfather built the golf course where you had your first turf job.
Right. When I started in turf school at the UW, the first thing that
it's going to take Love, off, man. It's awesome.
The first thing that Dr. Love does or did back then when he was in charge of the program and was mentoring all the students was to put you on a job with one of his former students. And so he got me a job at Nakoma Golf Course, which is a private golf course on the west side of Madison near where I lived, actually.
Very elite, actually. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Very nice. It was a beautiful golf course right on the edge of the University of Wisconsin's Arboretum.
UW.
Yeah, the UW, yes. So I was there for 3 years during my turf schooling and right up to the point when I left Madison for the Orioles. In fact, I went back there the first winter after the Orioles and worked there during the off season of baseball as well, working in taking care of the equipment, getting it ready for the following season, that kind of stuff. And and so I was kind of shocked when you said Nakoma Golf Course, because that's where I had, and it was just one of those things where it's like, oh my God, this is like amazing.
Yeah, it was like our a really unreal moment.
Our lives are coming together in amazing ways here. And sure enough, and I don't remember when we went out there, Did I take you around the course?
Yeah. We went around with, I think, the assistant. Yeah.
It was Charlie Frazier, who just retired, actually, just a year or two ago from there.
Yeah. And we went to the original front nine, which is what my great-grandfather had built. And actually, my grandfather grew up on that course. My grandfather was an exceptionally good golf player, or, you know, golfer. And I can't believe I said golf player. That sounds stupid.
That's just U-dub.
Yeah. and I'm not just saying that to brag. I mean, he had 11 holes in one, 9 of which were documented. He was asked to go pro, but this was back before they really paid any money to do that. He's played with Arnold Palmer and Sam Snead and some of the other greats in the industry. I mean, he really is a high-end, high-class golfer. And he learned to play at his first few golf strokes were taken at Nakoma. And it was one of the most remarkable experiences of my life. And what amazed me was I was pretty much able to tell which of the holes had been left to their original design. And I could tell.
How did you know? Had you seen plans somewhere?
No, but I was talking with Charlie, who was showing us around, and I remember asking him, I'm like, this one's original. And he would, yeah. And I would say, this one you've changed. And he said, yeah. Because I remembered playing golf with my grandfather, and I remembered the layouts that he loved. Mm. He had certain design elements that always made him, I hate to say giddy, but giddy. You know, he was more comfortable playing on a course that had a severe dog leg to the left. He was more comfortable playing on a blind fairway where, you know, you have that big rise in the middle and you can't see where you're shooting.
You're talking about the sixth hole in Nakoma has that.
Yep.
There's a huge hill going up and come back down. And that was always the dangerous hill for us on the crew because you'd go up the top of that hill and you didn't know if you were going to be met by a golf ball coming right at your forehead.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, Charlie took one right between the eyes on that
fairway
one time.
Oh, that's amazing.
And then of course, the severe dog leg you're talking about was actually the hole before that. Hole five has that severe dog leg to the right.
Or to the right, yeah.
Yeah, to the right that we always loved.
Yep. And there are little design elements that I remembered my grandfather loving when I was growing up and learning to play golf with him. And I found those, it was just weird to find those elements there in the golf course. It was a remarkable experience. It's a shame more of us can't have that kind of connection with our family and with our history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And we've got pictures galore of them from back in Nakoma and, you know, some from the newspapers. Albert shows the mayor of Madison how to play golf on the golf course or something silly like that. You know, but, and then they've got the women's group and they've, you know, and then my favorite is my great grandfather in his, I don't think it's correct to call it a wife beater t-shirt anymore. What do you, you know, just his underwear t-shirt.
Who says they have to be PC perfect here?
Right. In his underwear t-shirt, you know, the tank t-shirt, it's just him standing out there. I can't remember if he had like something hanging out of his mouth or not. He wasn't a smoker, but I think he had something hanging out of his mouth, and he's just duffing away out on the course when clearly nobody was around because that was rude, you know, but it was interesting. One of the other, you know, parts about this is knowing that the Bossards were essentially doing their own thing in sports turf while my family was, you know, tooling around doing their thing in golf turf. And it's fun to see where it stays in the family and you know, it's tough. Like Roger was saying, you kind of don't wish this life on your kids, but at the same token, you kind of wish this life on your kids because it's very few of us who ever get to, you know, your late 20s, your early 30s, your 40s, your 50s, and sit back and say, oh, thank goodness I'm doing something I like. Yeah.
There's a lot of people who suffer through life never getting to do what they really wanted to do or really loved.
Yeah.
I was lucky enough by the age of 29, to have already achieved my lifelong goal of being a head groundskeeper with the, you know, Orioles. And then I said to myself, well,
oh shit, now what?
Now what do I
do? I cussed. I'm going to have to beep that out.
So then I said to myself, now what am I going to do?
Yeah.
So, you know, but did you take any pictures that day when we were going around the?
I did.
Do you remember?
I took several. Yeah.
Do you still have them?
I'll pull a couple of them out. We'll put them in the show notes.
Yeah, put them in the show notes. Yeah. That'd be pretty cool.
I'll grab a couple of the old black and whites too.
Yeah. That'd be really neat to throw in there.
I'll see if I can find the one in the wife beater. That's a good one. You know, it's interesting. You know, my great grandfather did all of that during the Depression, and there were my grandfather till the day he died would not eat beets. Because sometimes that's all they
ate
for weeks on end. Well, I mean, they didn't have anything else to eat. You know, it was not a lucrative job, even, you know, because they used their own money to finance getting the course started and moved on to the next place and had to put down more money. And you're trying to do that during Depression era, you know, United States. And, you know, they very quickly, very easily ran out of money sometimes.
There's a couple greens there that are still the original push-up greens.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I remember that now. Yeah.
Number 9 is one of them. I'm trying to remember. I think there's 3 of them left. Number 9 is one of them. I don't remember what the other two were.
I can't believe they can still manage a push-up green that old. That's amazing.
Yeah. So now it may have changed since I've left there. I mean, I haven't been there in
but still,
a couple decades.
I mean, even though, yeah. Even if you and I visited 15 years ago, right, or 10 years ago, somewhere in there, I mean.
About 11 or 12 years ago.
That was 70, 80 years of the same green.
Yeah, exactly.
That's amazing. So,
well, with that little piece of family history and once again another connection that you and I had, it's just kind of amazing that we have all these different things. I think that's going to put this show in the books.
Oh, no book to slam this time, Paul? I thought that was your thing.
I'm sorry. That just kind of puts this show in the books.
There you go.
Fortunately, I have the Beacon Library right above me here to do that.
Excellent. It is an extensive library.
Yeah, there you go. Be sure to tune in next time to the Diamond of Itchies for more talk about ball field groundskeeping. And the best part is it's all free, you see, because that's the kind of deal we're going to strike up for you. Because, I don't know, we just like to give free stuff away around here.
Is that a promise?
That's right.
Our official webpage for the show can be found at beaconathletics.com/podcast. There you'll find our show notes where we'll include any papers or links or photos like we just discussed, my great-grandfather, during the episode. We'll have our pictures and bios up there too if you're curious, and you can take a look at who you're listening to. And we'll also put up some bonus material from time to time if we think we find something you'll find interesting.
And we'd love to hear from you. You can email Teresa and I at podcast@beaconathletics.com where you can send us your questions or comments on our show, good or bad. Or if you have show ideas, send them along to us. So we're busy answering the mountains of mail right now that have been flowing into the facility. I've gotten to the point where I've had to tell the mailman to stop.
And if by chance you're a Twitter follower, come check us out on Twitter. Our handle is @DiamondDaVincis. That's DAVINCIS. We're not crazy active there, but we will share things when we find them, especially while we're preparing for the show. If we come across anything that we might not get around to in the show, we'll put it up there as well.
The Diamond Da Vinci's podcast is sponsored by Beacon Athletics for over 67 years, providing solutions for sports field managers. And with that, all I can say is, that's all, folks.
Oh, don't say that.
Okay, I'll say sayonara.
There you go. Adios, folks. Talk to you later.